the elders have been talking through the next steps of this whole COVID-19 situation, and I've been doing a ton of research about what these next steps are. And about 3 weeks ago, I came across a study. One of my friends who's a pastor shared this, and it's put out by a group that is kind of chaplain-related and talks about how communities process through major things. They've done all kinds of research on things like natural disasters or like fires or earthquakes or hurricanes, and they've investigated kind of the different phases that they've gone through. And what they found is that it takes communities a while to go through this, to process through these major events. And it made me think about this whole COVID-19 situation because it's not a localized thing. This is really something that we are going through on a global scale. And it talks about four different phases. The first phase is a heroic phase. Now, I have this in your sermon notes, and hopefully you can see it. I know it may not be great on the screen with the background, but I still wanted to get it up there. And in this heroic phase, everybody just kind of pushes together and just kind of does everything they can. Here at Crossway, we did that. We did everything we could to put together online services. We're going to literally post a photo of this to see kind of the craziness that is here when we record a sermon to give you an understanding of kind of what it is. But also, not only that, we pulled together. We did the artwork for the nursing home. The kids did. We've offered to do different things for in the senior home behind us, as that's where I'm pointing to. And we've even done stuff where we've had people offer to come and help us, and it is great. It is awesome. It is a powerful thing. At the same time here, though, you kind of get this adrenaline rush, and you get through it. Well, the second phase is what they call a disillusionment phase. It's kind of where the reality of the weightiness of the situation sinks in. It's where things change, and you realize that they're never really going to be the same, and it weighs you down. For me personally, about 2 to 3 weeks ago, I kind of hit the wall, and this is really what it's talking about. It's not the wall, it just I can sense my frustration growing. I want to meet with you guys. I want to do worship with you guys. I don't want to have to text. I don't want to have to video chat. I want to be able to get together. I want to be able to have my kids be in school and not have all this stuff. And the kind of weight of it, the frustration kind of sunk in. And I don't know about you, but if I look at the community around us, I don't think I'm really alone in that. Quite frankly, I see in my Facebook feed the tension raising. I see protest outside of Battleground of the governor's orders, and I sense a tone and a frustration is rising. That's just the way that it is. And so there's this disillusionment phase, they say, and you have to go through it. You have to hit the wall. But ultimately, we move to a rebuilding and restoration phase where they're not in an adrenaline rush just to get things done. They've gone through kind of the lows of lament. And I want to encourage you, if you're in there, we have Psalms. One of our Psalms that we sing, songs that we sing here is Psalm 40. And the question that it asks is, how long, O Lord? And if you're in that disillusionment phase, I want to encourage you to pray those prayers of the Psalms that are laments. But after that, we move to this rebuilding phase. It's not adrenaline. It's in this, we can figure this out together. And how are we going to change things? How are we going to get through this? And then ultimately, it moves to a wiser living phase. Well, why do I share this? Well, one, I think it's good for us to kind of step back from our own kind of immediacy and see the big picture. And the big picture of this is it literally could take us 24 to 60 months to kind of process through all this stuff. And so that's there. It also, I think, allows us to kind of be honest and to admit that maybe we're in this disillusionment phase. Maybe we're in this frustrated phase. Maybe there are fears and certain things that are starting to grab our hearts more than we would like. And I'll name some of those a little bit later in the sermon, but there's fears. All of us, no matter what side of the spectrum we're at or in the middle, there's fears. There are things that we're frustrated with that we are dealing with. But also, I think it gives us hope that we can make the transition and move there. They say the one thing to know that your community has moved from this disillusionment phase to the rebuilding phase is that they can actually admit that there are going to be things that are going to be different. And they can really mourn that. They can look around and see the way that this whole situation has had an effect on us, for good or for bad. But yet they also can admit, and they can also see, that there's a mixed bag. That not everything is bad, there is also good. and then you can move to the rebuilding phase. Well, that's not the only reason why I bring this up. It's because this, I think this whole model is actually really good for us. And quite frankly, as I look at this, I think us going through the book of Ephesians and the text that we're going to look at today and tomorrow helps us in both of these phases. Today, the text that we're going to talk about is Ephesians 4, 1 through 6. Throughout this whole thing, Paul has taught us great, rich theology. We have been reminded about how God has worked powerfully in our lives. From in the very beginning, before we were not even here, the foundation of the world, how God chose us and he knew that he's going to work in our hearts to jumpstart our faith. Not only that, though, when he jumpstarts our heart and puts the Spirit there to enliven it, our hearts, to be open to the gospel and to put our hope and trust to that call. And it talks about how what Christ accomplished is he gave us peace with God and peace with one another. And then he prayed that we would have the ability to see this in the world around us. Now he's going to start shaping us and transition here to say, okay, now that you know all this stuff, how do you work it out practically in our lives? The image that I gave you last week is that of a camera. And basically what he did is he gave us a lens, maybe it's eyes, that we can see the world. And now that we've put those on, it's our job to kind of figure out how we engage with it and how we do this. And so this is kind of what he takes up. Now in this disillusionment and frustrated phase, it's easy to get angry with each other, to get frustrated. And I think these words are actually really timely for us. So if you can turn with me in your Bibles, we will be looking at Ephesians 4, 1 through 6. And the title of the sermon I have is called Learning to Walk in Faith. The sermon notes are, again, as I stated, on our website, or you can also do the YouVersion app. But we're going to look at six short verses, but I think that they have a lot to say. This is the word of the Lord. Therefore, as a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. Excuse me. Now, many of you know that my life history is that I graduated actually with a mechanical engineering degree. For 2 years, I designed mechanical fruit harvesters. I designed a grape harvester and a raisin harvester. And yes, I know they're both grapes, but they are different machines. I worked on an orange harvester and a coffee harvester, and it was fun. God's wired me to have certain gifts. Math and science comes quickly to me, and engineering used those gifts. But I was also really pretty miserable. I just kind of had this feeling that this is not what I was supposed to be doing. And so I was volunteering as a youth leader, and really the youth leader at Sunlight, his name was Jim Hilliott, took me under his wing and taught me the ropes, gave me more responsibility. And I started to feel the sense that maybe engineering wasn't what I needed to be doing for the rest of my life. And so I started to apply for some youth ministry jobs. Well, I'll never forget one job that I applied for in New York. I don't remember what church it is, thankfully, so I can't be too bitter against them. But I remember the interview. It went well. They asked the questions. And finally, one guy just frankly said, "So let me get this straight. You were called to engineering 2 years ago. That's what you thought, right? Yeah, that's why I did my degree. And now 2 years after that, just a short little time, you think you're called to youth ministry? How do you know God's call? How do you sense it? Seems like he would have made that clear to you in college, don't you think?" Not exactly the most encouraging interview, let's put it that way. But it made me think. Now, my response would be, you know, God had to use that. He had to let me know that engineering isn't what I was meant to be, to have a clear call to the other. But when we come to this passage and when we think about the term calling, we usually think it in a narrow focus. Like it's just pastors who are called. And people will ask me, "When did you know you were called?" Well, in this passage, Paul says that it's not just pastors who have calls. Matter of fact, in our tradition, we believe in the priesthood of all believers. And what Paul makes clear here is that all believers have received a calling from the Lord. Now, your calling may be to a certain vocation. Your calling may be to raise your kids at home. Your calling may be to be a volunteer in the community. Your calling is greater than just something is that is related to the church. Although you may be called to serve in different ways. And as we transition back into the church, we're going to probably need lots of volunteers. So I want you to encourage to think about that. But ultimately, today, what we see here is the calling of the way that we engage with one another in the world around us. And this is what Paul focuses on. Remember, he said, hey, look, there is this theological truce, this great narrative of how God has worked in your lives, and I want to impress this upon you. This is the lens that you need to look at the world, but you also need to realize that you have a calling from the Lord. Now, we use the NIV, and quite frankly, I love the NIV. I love the kind of way that it works back and forth with trying to come up with a dynamic equivalent of trying to get to communicate things across than maybe a less word-for-word kind of way. There's other great translations like the ESV or NASV. There's our joke in our digging deeper is we all have our favorite, the good ones, even though we don't really think they're that much better. But the NIV in this translation, I actually don't like because it misses an important word. It's a Greek word called un. Now, most of your translations that are more literal will say the word therefore. And I think it's important here because it's a big word. It's a big word that reminds us of what I've said a couple of times already in this sermon, and that is this, that for three chapters, Paul's communicated these deep theological truths that he wants to impress upon us. He has taught us that because he wants us to have these truths of how God worked in our lives and how it's more about God than and less about us. And that's the grand narrative that he wants us to feel. And the reason why he wants us to feel that, and he wants us to feel it, not just or know it in our head, but to feel it deep down into our hearts and in our souls, is because he's going to challenge us to then live out those theological truths. But he doesn't want us to think that this is going to earn God's love. No, no. He's already told us that believers are part of the family of God through Christ. And the therefore reminds us that all these truths that he's taught us are the way that we the way that the world is and the way that our lives are. God's worked in our lives. He's brought us to salvation. Our salvation is secure, not because of what we do, but because of what Christ has done. Now that we understand that, now that we feel that, now that we know his grace deep down to in our hearts, and we've been affected by it, well, then we can move into how do we live out this faith? How do we do that? The Bible uses often words like, in the Greek, they use tenses like indicative and imperatives. And indicative describes the way things are. That's three chapters. This is the way God's worked. It is. If you put your faith in Christ, if you're a believer, God's already worked this way in your lives. You can't change it. But there's also the imperatives. Now go live this out. Do this. And so that's what we see here, is that believers are called to walk and to learn how to walk in faith. That's the calling that you and I have received. He says it right there. Therefore, as a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live the life worthy of the calling you have received. Again, we're pretty passive in this. We've already received it. Now we need to walk in that. Most of you guys know that we've had an influx of baby goats in the Voss house. And I got to say, they're pretty cute. And they are providing goat therapy for the Voss family in the midst of this whole COVID-19 situation. Some of you have seen our photos. We've had the privilege of actually being at a couple of the different births, and I'm always surprised at the way God has created mammals in particular to live, but these goats. Right away, you're there, and this gross kind of wet kind of kid comes out, and the mama right away starts licking and cleaning him up, or we help maybe clean off the nose. But it's amazing to me how right after this, in a few minutes, these goats try and stand, and they're frail. They've never been outside in the open world. They've been inside in this closed thing, and yet there's this instinctual thing that they know they need to stand up, but they're not very good at it. Matter of fact, they're pretty wobbly. They kind of stand up, and then they kind of flop. And sometimes they literally will do the full flop where it's like all four legs are spread eagle, and you're like, oh, no, are they going to break? But within minutes and hours, they get more steady on their feet. And literally in a day, you'll be like, I can't believe that this is the same creature. They've learned how to walk. They're running around. They're doing all these things. They're gaining confidence in how to do that. If you have your own child who's in that toddler stage, you know that, right? Crawling is a new thing, and then all of a sudden, next thing you know, they're crawling everywhere, or walking is the same way. There's a confidence that builds. Well, this is the image that Paul wants us to have of this. He says, look, you need to learn how to walk. You need to learn how to walk in the life that I've called you to because of everything that Christ has done. So take those steps. Now, there's something I want us to think about this, because it's not just a one-time thing. Life will knock us down. We will be in kind of vertigo where we don't know how to respond. And Paul's encouraging us, no matter where we're at, no matter what situations we face, that we try and get up and learn how to walk. And he's going to describe how we're supposed to walk. But there's a couple of things that we're just going to do to summarize it. The first one is that believers are called to love Christ and make him the core of who they are. We've been talking about this a lot because this is the central theme in the book of Ephesians. Know those theological truths and what they say about who you are as a believer, and that is that the ultimate thing in your life, the core of your identity, is not your job, not your relationships, not your wealth or your status. It's none of those things. Your core identity from here on out is you are a child of God and part of the family of God because of what Christ has done. And this has to be central to who you are. It has to be so core to who you are that you take it for granted sometimes. Now, Paul talks about this again when he uses this phrase, the prisoner of the Lord. As we've said, this is the second or third time he's done it in the book of Ephesians. He is literally a prisoner of either Rome, probably of Rome, or maybe another country or a city. He's been a prisoner multiple times. But this man is a prisoner and bound by some magistrate. But he doesn't say, I'm a prisoner of those people. No, what he realizes is that ultimately he's a prisoner of the Lord, because being a follower of Christ is the core of his identity. And no matter what situation he's in, that's the main thing. And so he says, look, I am a prisoner of the Lord. And so we too need to make that the core of who we are. We're called to love Christ and make him the core of who we are. But we cannot do this alone. In fact, if we do and isolate ourselves, now granted we're in COVID-19 and we have some restrictions of when we can travel and do those kind of things. I get that. But we are called to love people and especially other believers. The language of this text focuses primarily on how we engage others in our local body. And what we see here is that how we engage each other is important. Quite frankly, it's easy to love people when we don't have any contact with them. I mean, we feel lonely and it brings up a whole other issue. But when people come together from a variety of different perspectives and a variety of different backgrounds, of course chaos is going to happen and toes are going to get stepped on, and we're going to challenge each other to have the rubber hit the road and have us actually live out this life that we talk about. And it's not always easy. Quite frankly, the church, the more that we do life together, the more we're going to step on each other's toes, the more potential to harm each other, and that's why this kind of a passage is so important. Especially in this kind of time, too, when we're in this disillusionment phase, where there's a frustration and maybe an anger inside of us. It also is not only a reminder for how we engage with the community here at Crossway, or the local believers around us, but also our community around us. And so today, I want you to see that there are five characteristics that I think Paul talks about of walking in faith. These are the muscles that we have to kind of flex if we want to grow in becoming more Christ-like. And the first word that he uses is humility. He says, be completely humble and gentle. Now, what you need to understand is this goes totally against the Greco-Roman world. In the Greco-Roman world, especially if you're a teacher, the way that you kind of scored points and the way that you rose in prominence is by being able to be articulate and create these zingers. It's more about your oratory style and about your content. Matter of fact, content didn't really matter. It was just kind of the way that you could puff yourself up and present yourself to the world. This is the way they valued it. And matter of fact, to them, it was just, you know, as long as you had success, then you could be okay. And Paul says, no. This is not the way that Christians are supposed to live. Bravado is not something that should happen there. No, that's not it. You need to be humble, he says. He talks about it in 1 Corinthians 8 and 9, where he says, look, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And the idea here is that we shouldn't be around like a rooster kind of strutting himself around saying, hey, look at me, how great I am. And this is the kind of image that we communicate. That's the puffiness of it. No, rather what he says is, we need to have a confidence in ourselves, but we need to have a humility. And he describes what that humility is in multiple places, but Philippians 2 is by one of the most powerful. It's Romans 12:3. It says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus Christ. And Romans 12:3 says, for by grace given me, I say, every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you. Now, what does that mean? What it means is that we always are reminded of our brokenness. That actually, the more we grow in our Christian faith, the more humble we should be. And quite frankly, I'll say it, the more that we grow in a Reformed or Calvinistic view of faith, where we truly believe what we've taught here in all of Ephesians, that everything is about God, the more that we should just be blown away that God would, in some grand thing of his own choosing, work in our hearts and bring us to faith, that should humble us even more, because it's not about us at all. And what he says is, the more in tune we are to that, the more we allow the gospel to sink deep down into our hearts, that we engage people in a humble way, because we realize that that is exactly what Christ did. Christ didn't cheat us the way our sins deserve. Christ could have strutted around this place because he's the only one who lived the sinless life, but he didn't. He was rejected and beaten and falsely accused. His friends ditched him. And yet, in humility, he took the cup that he didn't really want to take, the cup of judgment. And he did it because he submitted to the Father's will. And when that sinks down into our hearts, that's the attitude that we have towards one another. This word that's translated to be completely humble really means a lowliness of mind. Anytime I talk about humility here at Crossway Church, you're probably going to hear a quote from Tim Keller. And it's from a book called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. And if you want to read it, it is a really short little book. It is as small as it can get. In it, he really talks about how when we build our identity on Christ, we don't have to look to others for our approval. And we don't have to build, we also don't have to look at our own success for approval. And when we're freed from that, how it humbles us. But humility isn't what you think, to where we just say, oh, well, I'm humble, and self-deprecating. No, there's a self-confidence there. But the self-confidence doesn't exert itself in the way that we relate in a puffiness. Rather, what it does is it provides us with a self-forgetfulness. When we don't have to look at people in a transactional way, that they can affirm us or they can do what we want so that we can feel good about ourselves, then quite frankly, because of what Christ has done and because he's filled our hearts, then quite frankly, we think of ourselves less. When we engage in a conversation, we don't think, well, what's this person think about me? And we're consumed by that. We don't think about, well, what can this person accomplish for me? Or we don't get frustrated because, well, that person's taking valuable time from me and I need to get this done in order to feel good about myself. No, there's a self-forgetfulness about it. He says, the essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of myself or thinking less of myself. It is thinking of myself less. The truly gospel humble person is a self-forgetful person whose ego is just like his or her toes. It just works. It does not draw attention to itself. The toes just work. The ego just works. Neither draws attention to himself. The point here is this. The more that we allow Christ's love to dictate who we are, the more secure that we feel about that, the more that we can kind of forget all these things that can easily hook us. And we can just be with people. And when you are in the presence of the humble people, really your conversations, you think, well, what did we talk about? A lot of it may be talking about you, because they want to know you. They want to engage you because they're free to do that, because the gospel has had that kind of impact of their lives. They may challenge us. They may encourage us. They may even speak quite frankly into our lives, but you're going to tell by their tone and their demeanor that they care for us. One of the guys that has done this most in my life is unfortunately gone. His name was Pastor Ken Kuhman, and if you've been here at Crossway Church, you've heard me talk about him. He was a pastor who helped me discover my gifting and the call to ministry. Now, he was the pastor of the church that I served as a youth pastor with as well. And even when I would run into Pastor Ken and all kinds of different settings, right away, even though I'd ask him about himself or what's going on with his family, he would answer those questions. But primarily what he was interested in was not himself and communicating all these things that he's done, but rather, how's Brad? How are you doing? How are you feeling? How are you doing in ministry? How is life really going for you? You walked away from those conversations edified because he asked about you because he didn't have to worry about himself. And Paul says, this is the kind of conversations that we need to be about. Now, I want you to think about this practically. In this sermon, I'm going to hit things hard. I'll just be honest with you, because this passage hits us hard. And today, I want you to think about the tone of the people you listen to. Is it puffy or prideful, or is it humble? What is your own tone and posture towards other people? Now, I ask you about this, who do you listen to, because we live in a very virtue, what some scholars call a virtue signal calling or a call-out culture, where and a polarized culture, where quite frankly, part of where a lot of us get some of our being is by pointing out how we are better than others and calling them out, either in the inconsistency of their argument or in the in how they're completely crazy and just, or how they've done something completely wrong. And that's half of the social media posts we see sometimes is this kind of thing, or where we not talk about the issue, but rather we bash the person and do that. In this culture, it is so easy to get sucked into that kind of a thing if we allow those people to fill our minds. Now, I'm not saying don't read the news. I'm not saying don't listen to those channels, but we need to be able to recognize it for what it is. That there is in our culture a tone and a lack of civility, a lack of humility. And so we can't just blindly go into that culture and accept that. We need to fight it. We need to be humble. And one of the best ways to do that is by surrounding us with humble people who model this kind of behavior for us, that aren't condescending, who aren't scoffing, who don't make people who may not be as smart as them or know as much as them feel that way in their presence. Rather, they just want to know where you're at, what you're learning, what you're engaging with, and that we want to be those kind of people who are humble that way. The second phrase in there is that people are gentle. Now, it says be completely humble and gentle. Now, the definition I'd like to give you for gentleness is this. It's a controlled strength that displays a tenderness towards other. Again, this totally went against the culture of their day. The culture of their day was any kind of meekness or it was weakness. And if you didn't puff yourself up and act like you have all your life together, then you're not going to win. And again, I think this really hits similar to our culture today. Our strength is in our bravado. Our strength is in our ability to be sarcastic and tear people down. And I got to tell you, quite frankly, this is something I struggled with a ton, especially in my younger days, and I still continue to struggle it. This bravado is hard. It's something to come against. But what Jesus says here through the words of Paul, what God wants us to hear is that gentleness and humility is our posture towards one another. And gentleness is not weakness. It's a strength. And it has a power inside of us. But even though it doesn't use it to bully itself around, rather it's a tenderness towards others. Now, the image that I used when we preached through gentleness was that of a stallion. My girls like to watch the show Spirit. Well, at least my younger one does now. And it's this wild horse who runs free and has a power and elegance to it. But yet there's a tenderness in its relationship with its owner, Lucky. Even though he's powerful and mighty and can do all these things, it's part of the narrative of the story. It's also this tenderness there. And what this says is this is the image that we need to have. We need to have a strength. We need to be grounded by our faith, and we need to not be afraid to speak boldly against things. But we need to be careful about how we do it. That we're humble, one, open to hearing other ideas, that when we share our ideas, that there's a humility there, that people just hear us stating the facts or don't feel made fun of because we communicate that. But also that there's a gentleness, and that gentleness may seem that we are pick our battles or that we're careful about what we say when we say it. It's a controlled strength. That's what it is. And so I want to ask you this question: how gentle are you, and who do you struggle to be gentle with the most? My guess is it's probably those who are closest to you, your family members, your coworkers. But these are the people that we're called to be. Maybe it's the people who annoy you the most, let's be honest. Maybe it's the other side of the political spectrum or whatever view you have. You have a tough time being gentle with them. But this is how we're called to live. The third characteristic is being patient with circumstances and others. It says, be completely humble, be gentle, be patient, and bear with one another in love. The word here in Greek is makrothumia, and it literally means long-suffering. What it means is that you have this ability to endure. I love this quote, and this is the quote that I added in your sermon notes. If you printed them off early, that won't be there. But it's from a scholar who wrote a commentary in the book of Ephesians, and he says this. His name is Kyle Snodgrass. Patience is the exercise of a largeness of soul that can endure annoyances and difficulties over a period of time. What do you think about that? What Paul said is when you're so overwhelmed by the love of Christ in your soul, when that's the core identity of who you are, your soul is so big and the amount of love is so huge in it that those pebbles that are thrown from other people or those life circumstances, that if you have a small pool, will have this huge tidal wave effect. When it's big, will just be little ripples there because the love of God in your soul is greater and bigger. This is the kind of person, this is what it means to be walking in the ways of the Lord. Now, it doesn't mean that we're going to do it perfectly, but it means rather that what we're going to have to do is enliven our souls and make them bigger so that we can be patient with one another and life circumstances. This COVID-19 situation, being cooped up with your family, dealing with people from different perspectives are going to push our patience, but we are called to do that. There's another image that I think is a powerful one, and that is one of dealing with patience is that of landmines. Look, the opposite of long-suffering is a person with a hair-trigger temper who explodes in fury and rage and rejection at the slightest provocation. Let's be honest. We all have things that set us off. We have these things that are like landmines. For those of you who aren't familiar with landmines, back in the day, when conflicts happened, to keep the enemy out and to create a huge amount of casualty, they had put these mines that if people stepped on, would blow up. They didn't always know that they were there, and so they were quite effective. Well, we have landmines in our own personality, in our DNA, of who we are. We have those things that can trigger us, either because of past experiences or even current situations. And one counselor says that every being has them, but patient people learn how to remove them. They learn how to avoid them. Think about that. The people who you are with, who are most patient, are not the ones who get triggered easily. They don't have these things that just explode. No, they are patient, and they can navigate their way around it. Now, this is hard work. Let's just be honest. We all have them. We all have these trigger points. They can easily get flared. But what Paul says is that we need to do the hard introspective work. To one, recognize them, to say, What are those things? Be curious. Why is it that I got so angry when that person did that? Why is that a landmine? And two, that we do the hard work of trying to remove them. But recognizing is the first place, to be aware of them. Maybe it's being aware that, hey, when somebody has a certain tone, I don't like it. But maybe I'm not, maybe I can read that tone into things a little bit. Maybe sometimes it's just avoiding conversations, not completely, but when you know that you're triggered and it's not the right time. There's all kinds of things that we can trigger us, but Paul says we need to learn to be patient people and remove these landmarks, lines away from us. We need to learn to enlarge our souls to the gospel so that these little things don't affect us as much. And so today I want to ask you those questions. What are your emotional landmines? What are those things that can easily set you off? Well, there's another one, and that is another characteristic of walking in faith, and that is that he bears with or puts up with each other in love. It says, be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another. Now, I don't know about you, but bearing with one another sounds pretty archaic, doesn't it? It's not really language I use. I'd say, hey, sometimes we just need to learn to put up with one another. When Christians come together, when we do life together, we are going to step on each other's toes. We're going to step on each other's toes. That's just the way that it is. But when we do so, we have a decision. How do we respond? Are we going to respond in forgiveness? Or are we going to respond in bitterness and anger? The love word that he uses here is an agape, which says that it enjoys the other person, but it's not all about us. Rather, it's not, this kind of love isn't a feeling, but it's an act of the will. And when our toes are stepped on, when we're frustrated, when we want to do everything we can not to be patient, not to be humble, not to be gentle, lay the smack down, either verbally or worse. We need to remind ourselves that we have a choice. And that choice is, are we going to try to be quick to forgive? Are we going to let love cover a multitude of sins? And if it's so great that we need, that it really weighs down to us, are we going to do the hard work that the Bible tells us to have the conversations, to challenge our brothers and sisters, to say, you know what, you really did hurt my feelings, and that could be the most loving thing. And in that way, we bear with one another, and we put up with one another. It's a decision that we make. But Paul says, if we want to walk in our faith, if we want to grow in our faith, this is the attitude that we have towards one another. There's one other thing here, and that is this. Defends the unity in the church. Now, I got to admit, when I read through this passage, and kind of the way I work through a text usually is I read through it myself in the English version, and I just kind of write all these notes on a piece of paper or in a journal, and I craft this. And as I go through this, you could see these 5 points kind of come out, and when I first came to it, I read it, and I'm like, okay, I need to work towards unity, work towards it. I need to work towards creating it. Like, I need to put these building blocks in place to create it. But as I read one commentator, or a bunch of commentators, they all highlighted this work, a couple of the way that these words work. It says, it doesn't say build. It says make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. Now, if you think about this, what Paul's actually said in the book of Ephesians, in Ephesians 2, is, look, in particular, hey, Christ created peace. He took two groups, the Jews and the Gentiles, who hate each other, and he made you one group. And that peace is there. So it's not a matter of us building unity. It's living out the unity that should already be there in Christ. And our job is to defend it. So we're not builders. Rather, through all these attitudes that we've had, we're more like the security guards checking our own attitudes within and those coming in and out to make sure that the unity of the church is safe. And he says that it's not just the pastor's job, not just the elder's job or the deacon's job. It's all of our job to defend the unity in the church. Now, what we need to see here is, one, that the unity is already there in Christ. Christ has created that peace. But two, that there will be people, even well-intended people, who are trying to break the unity of a church. That's just the human nature and the fallen nature of who we are. We have that own desire in ourselves. We want to create these cliques. We want to create these groups, or we want to belittle people. That's the nature that he's been fighting against in this whole text. But that's not the way the church works. The church works to defend unity. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to agree on everything. Matter of fact, it doesn't mean we have to be the same or uniform. Matter of fact, next week, I'm excited because we're going to talk about the rebuilding phase, and we're going to look at it to see how God wired you differently than me, than Brian, than everyone. But we need each other. So unity does not mean that we're uniform. Matter of fact, the best way that we can show that Christ is the thing that glues us together is when there's diversity amongst us. But rather, how are we going to treat one another when we disagree? That is the power of the gospel, is when we disagree and when we feel even passionately about it, that we have the ability, because of the humility and the gentleness, our ability to bear with one another and to be patient, that we can have great conversations. We can open up the scriptures and go and say, really, how does all this thing line up? And how does this principle work with this principle? But ultimately, we may come to the point where there are some things where maybe unity isn't there, and we don't have, or where we disagree. But we don't tear each other down. We don't try and split up the church. No. We still be patient. We still be bearing with one another. And we need to work at that. We need to look at our own hearts and say, what are the ways that I kind of make fun of others in the church? What are the ways that I belittle other people's viewpoints? Not so humble, not so gentle. I need to look at defending unity within my own heart and within the actions of others. So, how can you defend the unity of Crossway? Now, how does this work out practically? We are in the midst of an unprecedented time with COVID-19, and so I'm going to just talk frankly, guys, because I don't know any other way. I've seen our Facebook posts. I've talked to you. I know that many of you here at Crossway, we have a complete spectrum of how we view this whole thing. We have some of us who want to stay at home and are frustrated by those that don't. We're mad when we don't see people wearing masks. We feel like they're not taking this thing seriously, and we're all going to get hurt because of it. We think the curve can still spike, and we're not through it. And so we're frustrated by others' people's actions. Some of us are done with COVID-19. We think it's all overblown. We're worried about government overreaching and the economy and people losing our job, even ourselves. Some of you have lost your jobs or had hours cut. You may have to shut down certain things. You don't want anything to do with masks. You think they're ridiculous. They don't do any purpose. So why would I do that? Because the government shouldn't be telling me what I need to be doing anyway. And some of us are in the middle. You think the government did the best decision that they could. They may have a prejudice against churches, but it's time to start reopening at a slower pace. And quite frankly, you're annoyed at the bitterness that you see on both sides, and you're kind of sick of social media. So how do we live out this passage? Here we are with a mixed up congregation with multiple people. How do we do it? Well, Paul says we need to humbly listen to one another. Rather than being quick to spout off our own views, we need to ask those who disagree with us what motivates our decisions. I want you to think about that yourself. What is your motivation for your reactions? One of my friends who's a pastor said, everybody in this whole thing has some level of fear. Now, we don't like to use that word, so maybe just use the word anxiety or things that stress you out or frustrate you, but what is it? For some of us, it's the fear of health issues. For some of us, it's the economy. For some of us, it's the government overreach. For some of us, it's just seeing the polarized world become even more polarized, or the unknown. But all of us have some level of fear or anxiety amongst this. And so when somebody shares your view that's different than you, listen to them. Ask them, what is the fear? And don't diminish it. You don't know what life situations they've gone through or what kind of things they are facing. There are health issues in here that many people don't know. There's people who've lost their jobs that you may not know about. And ask, what is it that's behind this? Don't label people or diminish them. Don't think of yourself as the only one with everything you know. But listen with an open mind. When you speak to one another, be civil, be gentle, do it with respect. Watch your tone. Don't call them belittling names, either externally with your mouth or internally with your heart. And try and put yourself in their shoes. Be patient. Be mindful of the hot button topics that come up your way. Don't not talk about it, but maybe when you do talk about it, make sure that you're in the right mindset and able to do it. When somebody sends you a text or email or posts something on Facebook that can make you feel that pressure inside build, take a deep breath. Do what relational wisdom said. Take a drink of water. Let your brain catch up with your emotions. And definitely don't quick type that text and fire it away. Or make a comment. Be patient. In the midst of this whole COVID-19 and the uncertainty, the circumstances are going to make us learn how to walk. Things may change. We may have to make some adjustments. Be patient with that. How do we bear with one another? Well, if you're at the stay-at-home crew, when someone isn't wearing a mask, give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they're claustrophobic or can't breathe as much through it. Maybe it's because their own fear is driving it. If your COVID-19 is completely overblown and masks don't do anything, maybe think about this. Just because you have a right doesn't mean you have to use it. Matter of fact, I encourage you, in 1 Corinthians 8 through 9 talks about how do you deal with things when you have a right and you deal with those who are may be threatened by that right. And in the way that you treat it is not by being cocky or arrogant, but rather by sometimes willfully submitting to their will, even though you think it's completely false. And so maybe you think a mask does nothing, but you know that for the sake of the fear of people around you, including those in Crossway, maybe you'll wear a mask when you're out at the store. Or as we think about opening up, and we think about what that's going to be, and maybe the governor has different rules, maybe you do wear a mask in church or something like that, if that's what the government requires, even though you don't think it's that way. And if you're in the middle of the road, don't think you're better than everybody else just because you're in the middle. Don't belittle them and say, oh, they're a bunch of kids who are fighting. Don't let pride seep in and think that you have it all figured out. Bear with one another. And how do you defend unity? At some point, we're all going to have to start. We're going to have to get back into society. And for some, that's not going to be fast enough. And others, it's going to be too quick. And when we come together, especially as we come together to worship, and as we think about that, don't bash Crossway's leaders for the decisions they're making. Realize it's a tough decision. Work even to think about how you can have that same attitude towards your leaders. But let's work to understanding one another and understanding the fear and the anxiety that guides our decisions. And let's do everything we can to keep ourselves humble, but yet at the same time, move forward together. This is what learning to walk in the COVID-19 situation is. Humble, gentle, patient, bearing with one another, and unifying. Now, what are those things that unite us? Why is this possible? And this is really where Paul hits. He lists a great, I mean, it's a list of a lot of things here, but there's one word that's repeated over and over again. What is it? In verse Ephesians 4 through 6. One body, one spirit, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father. The oneness of all this. Paul's just talked about how he took a people who were not part of the family of God, who hated each other, and made them part of the family, one family of God. And he wants to remind the people that the way that we can be patient, the way that we can be gentle, the way that we can bear with one another, the way that we can be humble, the way that we can defend the unity that's already there, we just need to defend it, is by reminding and remembering the oneness about us. Yes, we are diverse, but we are unified because God has worked in our lives. The triune God has brought us to faith. That is a bond that is going to connect us. Do you see that language here? He uses all three parts of the Trinity here. One Spirit, one Lord, that's Jesus Christ, and one God and Father. And this is the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So the work of all of them has drawn us to faith and put us there. And not only that, he's called us to a local body of believers. He uses that kind of language of one body, one baptism. It doesn't mean that it's all, and one faith. It doesn't mean that we all have to agree on the mode of baptism or that, but what it means is that we've publicly declared to a body of believers that we have faith in one another, that we have faith in God, and we are joining together with one another. But his last words there are the ultimate hope of which we can have. It's the only way that we can get through all these circumstances, and the way that we can bear one another or forgive one another and have unity and be humble and patient with one another, and that is this. That God is over all and through all and in all. And what it reminds us of is that even though we're disillusioned, even though we're frustrated, even though we may want to cry out, how long, Lord, do we really need to put up with all of this stuff? Paul says, you need to remember, God called you to faith. God put you in a body of believers. But more importantly, God is the one who can use all of these things, even the messed up things, to challenge us and to encourage us to grow. And this is the hope that we bank our lives on. This is the hope that we have as believers. And it's that truth that's going to get us through the difficult days, get us past the disillusionment, to bear with one another, to forgive one another, to be patient with one another, to work towards unity to one another, to be humble and to be gentle with one another. And in doing so, learn to walk in the light that God has called us. Let's pray.
You are listening to a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. You can learn more about our church online at crosswaychurchwa.com. We invite you to attend a worship service on Sundays at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway.